This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the beautiful hill country of Texas. My guest today, and you are going to want to listen to this show all the way to the end. And you're like, bro, I don't got the time. It's an hour and a half show. Skip to the end if you can't listen to the whole show, because I talked to Chris Slattery, who is a pioneer and a hero. He is the founder of Expectant Mother Care in New York City. It's been there since 1984, and Chris Slattery is a pioneer in the pregnancy center movement. We talk a lot about that in the beginning. We talk about the history of Planned Parenthood. But at the end, Chris was given a terminal diagnosis with cancer, and we talk about that. We talk about his relationship with God. We talk about the process of being given a terminal cancer diagnosis, and I think that's something I would like everyone to hear. Chris says his only goal is that people get closer to God. And you know, that is the sort of secret reason I have this podcast. The secret reason is I like in my own way to help everyone get closer to God. That's it. And also to order their life to serve the vulnerable members of our family so that those vulnerable people can become closer to God, because violence is a great scandal and violence can separate us from our Creator. And so that is really the goal. And so when Chris said that, it really moved me. So you're going to want to listen to the whole show. This episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project. Go to our website, thegreatcampaign.org. Go to our website, thegreatcampaign.org. Look around. And if you don't think, what? How are they doing all this? This organization is unbelievable. What they're doing in Afghanistan and around the world. If you don't think immediately, I've never seen any organization do so much. If you don't think that, if you're not blown away when you go to thegreatcampaign.org, don't donate. If you're like, oh, this is a great group, don't donate. But if you're like, this is absolutely incredible, they're building women's centers in Afghanistan today. They're rescuing how many people from Afghanistan, Christians and other minorities, and are those who fought alongside of us in the war on terror. If you are not totally blown away, don't donate. But if you are blown away, then you need to become a monthly donor. We really need to increase our level of monthly giving because we're inundated with calls for support. Afghanistan, especially the Christian and minority communities, are already collapsing into hunger, and it's the middle of summer, and I have a pit in my stomach. And we are working overtime here to try to lessen the brutality of the coming famine in Afghanistan. So go to thegreatcampaign.org, the Vulnerable People Project is our main sponsor. And this episode is also being brought to you by Mike Lindell's MyPillow. Now, I've been doing in my commercials, I've been telling you, you need to get the robe and you need to get the slippers for when the FBI drags you out of your house in the middle of the night, you're looking good. And you're like, Jason, that's over the top. You've lost your mind. No, but now you know. Mike Lindell had his phone taken today by the FBI. So what I want us all to do, all of us, is go to MyPillow.com. I'm going to do it too. And buy some pillows. Buy some Giza Dream sheets. Go to MyPillow.com. When you use the code Jones, you are getting the world's best discount, no better discounts with any other code. This is the code. You get the discounts, the best discounts. And you took Mike's cell phone. I'm going to show you. I need some new pillows anyway. You took Mike Lindell's cell phone. It's about time I slept properly. I'm getting a mattress topper. How dare you take Mike Lindell's cell phone? Well, he's just trying to get a burger. I'm getting me the Giza Dream Sheets. That's what we're all going to do. So go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and we will show this decaying, corrupt federal police agency, the FBI. We're going to show them what's what. What's what? You take Mike Lindell's cell phone, I'm getting myself a pillow. If you raid his house, I'm getting the mattress topper, the Giza Dream Sheets. I'm going to get the robe and I'm going to get the slippers over there on MyPillow.com, and I'm going to use the code Jones. We're going to show them. That's how we show them. And we're going to do it laughing. We're going to smile because you know what? Tyranny is a joke. Bureaucrats who abuse their authority are clowns, and they're funny and they're ridiculous to me. I laugh at them. There was the great Catholic saint Miguel Pro, who would literally dress up as a clown holding balloons in front of the police station when the communist government of Plutarco Caez forbid confessions, and he would say, look for me in front of the police station, I'll be dressed as a clown, and stand next to me and I'll hear your confession. How's this? This is what the kind of guy I like. Then the next day, he'd be like, I'll be selling the newspapers in front of the new police station. Come by, buy a newspaper, talk to me, I'll hear your confession. See why? Because this saint, Miguel Pro, knew that Plutarco Caez and his regime were ridiculous and would cease existing soon. And this half tyranny, this attempt at tyranny is going to fall on its face, and they're a joke. Taking Mike Lindell's phone, joke. MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, get yourself a pillow, and laugh while you're doing it. And also, to stay free, you have to stay informed. And now more than ever, you know that the mainstream media is a farce. The mainstream media is a farce that generates false memes and spews lies and gaslights the American public. And if you want to cut through all the nonsense, go to iReadEpoch.com, use the code Jason Jones, and you will get a great discount on the newspaper. $77 for the year. Dollar for the first month. Try it out. Dollar for the first month. Try it out. And I promise you, I will never, ever on this show, I didn't even want sponsors. And then Mudhouse Media came to me and said, we got you, Mike Lindell. I said, do it. Then they came and said, Epoch Times wants in. I'm like, Epoch Times? It's my favorite newspaper. So you need to go to iReadEpoch.com. Use the code Jason Jones. Steve Bannon calls it the most important daily win sheet in America, and you get the best discount. All right, now on with my interview with a true legend, a hero, a great man, Chris Slattery, on the Jason Jones Show. Chris Slattery, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Great to be on again, Jason.
Now, question, has the FBI raided your house yet?
No, I've actually had friendly relations with the FBI, although when they first called me after Dobbs and the attacks on pregnancy centers began, I kind of bawled out one of the FBI agents because I was really pissed off they weren't defending the Supreme Court justices at their homes.
I was kidding because, you know, today the FBI took a Mike Lindell's phone at a fast food restaurant.
At a Denny's, of all places.
At a Denny's. And you are the first pro-life leader that I knew to endorse Trump. And at the time, I was for Cruz, and so I wrote you off forever. I cast you to the outer darkness.
Yes.
I was very upset with you because I didn't believe that Trump. We did a whole show on this. I'll put in the show notes. But I tipped the FBI off to you, and I said, you should probably get Chris Slattery's phone, too. So I was just wanting to know if they called you yet. But you were actually thinking about the FBI in relationship to the attacks on centers like Expectant Mother Care, which you are the founder.
Yes, well, we were a target. We were featured in the New York Times the day after the Dobbs decision. They had been working on a story for about a month, and they wanted to kind of make pregnancy centers look bad, and they ended up with a misleading headline. They were claiming there were more pregnancy centers in New York City than abortion facilities, which they were misled on that by some pro boards. That's grossly inaccurate.
Wait, are there more abortion clinics in New York City than pregnancy centers?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
They're double the number. Well, if you want to include hospitals, they're probably three or four times as many and doctors that do abortion pills in their office.
And pharmacies. Yeah, now pharmacies just do over-the-counter. Facilities. Yeah.
Yeah. But we only have one strong pregnancy center in Brooklyn and in the Bronx, which we run. And in Queens, there are a handful of centers, or two on Staten Island and two in Manhattan. Not a lot of competition for the abortion clinics of New York City and the hospitals that almost all do abortions if they have maternity care.
So help me try to understand this. So in the mentality of the New York Times or of the average New Yorker, The idea that there are more centers willing to help women who want to choose life with their baby than abortion clinics is good propaganda. So they lied about that. Because to me, in my mind, if I was an advocate for abortion, I would want to celebrate that there's more of our centers, that we're more committed to helping women, blah, 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 blah. We're everywhere. But in their mind, you guys are such the boogeyman. There are these pregnancy centers everywhere.
Well, I'm a boogeyman, and our places are the worst boogeymen because we're in the same building as the Planned Parenthood of Brooklyn since 1999 and across the street from the Planned Parenthood in the South Bronx since 1995. So we have been really close to enemy territory, as close as you can get, in two of the major abortion sites in New York City. So they've hated me for decades in New York in the pro-abortion movement. I mean, I outlasted the early pro-aborts who are mostly dead or long retired. I'm almost to two generations of pro-lifers because I started in the late 70s and I'm still going in the 2000s, 2020s. So, you know, I'm a long time activist that really got my start in my early 20s and realized early on I had to take on these abortionists. This is the abortion capital. This is the center of where most of the abortion groups were founded, where Planned Parenthood Federation of America is headquartered, where NARAL was founded, where the abortion activists like Dr. Nathanson, Dr. Lawrence Lader, Gloria Steinem, many of these people who helped establish the abortion industry started here, were based here. And Planned Parenthood still schemes and connives and misleads and misinforms everyone based out of their strategy formed right here in Manhattan.
That makes sense. That's where I would expect to be formed. Is there still a Margaret Sanger Boulevard in New York City? I heard rumors that they were going to change the name. Did they ever end up changing the name?
They did. It was Margaret Sanger Square.
Okay.
After George Floyd, the black employees at Planned Parenthood of New York City revolted. And they finally came out of the closet against Margaret Sanger. They had heard from pro-lifers for years that she was a racist and a eugenicist, and they probably knew it and they put up with it. But after Floyd, they revolted against the white leadership of the Planned Parenthood of New York City. They changed the name of the Margaret Sanger Center, which was their Manhattan abortion clinic and administrative building. They just dropped the name. And then a couple years later, I think this year, New York City took down the street sign, which is New York City's responsibility. It was Margaret Sanger Square.
Pray God. You know, here's if you're listening to this and you are a leftist icon, I don't know if there are any leftist icons out there, any heroes of the left, the radical left listening, Sean King, I don't know, you may be. You should know that will be the left that tears down your statue. And eventually, after we beat the drum for decades, isn't it interesting, Chris, how then they come along and finally acknowledge what we have been saying forever, which actually the Black Panthers in the 60s and 70s were saying, that Planned Parenthood's an instrument of structural racism, that Margaret Sanger is a virulent racist. And now, finally, after all of these years, they are distancing themselves from their founder.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went out to the location maybe 10 years ago with the activist from Washington, D.C., Reverend Patrick Mahoney, and we tracked down the location of the original Planned Parenthood predecessor organization founded by Margaret Sanger in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn. It was a combination of a cell phone store and a furniture store. Not the same business, but they took up the space of where she had opened. It was a dangerous neighborhood. I mean, cops were telling these two white guys in Brownsville, Brooklyn, when we were hanging out there, what are you guys doing here? You don't want to be around this neighborhood. Get out of this neighborhood. it was still dangerous. I mean, it was a tough neighborhood 100 years ago. It's still a tough neighborhood now. And she founded this organization here in New York City, and she, Margaret Sanger did not openly advocate abortion. She did it secretly because she basically, her prime were in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, 20s through the 50s. Through the early 60s before she got sick and died. And they weren't openly advocating abortion at Planned Parenthood until the mid to late 60s after she was had fallen ill and then died. But they were behind the scenes. She was promoting abortion secretly behind the scenes. And of course, she wrote in numerous magazines that she published and interviews that she gave that, you know, Planned Parenthood was targeting the weak and wanted to exterminate basically the weeds of society that included, you know, recent immigrants to America from Southern Europe and Catholics and blacks, and they started the Negro Project to get the pastors to try and get their congregations on birth control, get them to limit their family size. Perhaps she was promoting illegal back alley abortions to pastors to tell their congregants who got unexpectedly pregnant, you know, to use our network of back alley abortionists.
Yeah, so, and, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
When you think of Margaret Sanger, like in the 30s with the Negro Project, that's what she named it, paying off black pastors to promote birth control and population control or birth control as a path to prosperity. While she's writing her funder Gamble of Procter and Gamble, that their authentic goal is the extermination of the black people, and they had to keep this a secret. I mean, this is available to anyone. And now, sure. Now even Planned Parenthood accepts this. And you brought that they were, Margaret Sanger and her donors were sort of like Puritans who had lost their faith in God. They were the descendants of the Puritans. And they had this sort of, those who funded Margaret Sanger, they were repulsed by the Irish, the Czech, the Poles, the Germans. And a lot of the same folks that were funding this decriminalization of abortion, this push for abortion, were the same folks that were pushing the teetotaler laws, which is kind of interesting. Like, you think it was the money. The folks that were pushing the abolition of booze were the same people pushing birth control. And it's because they saw the Irish or the Polish or the Czech or the German guys, they'd finish building a skyscraper and then go get their shot and a beer. And to these, really, they're just kind of like the left today. They're soulless, they're godless Puritans, soulless, lifeless, spiritlessness. They had no spirit. They had no thumos. And so it's really, their ideologies have changed the advocates of abortion in a way from the early 20th century to today, 100 years later. But what they share in common is that they are just dull, lifeless, boring people.
Well, they had bad intentions too.
Yeah. So that's the difference. Control. So today, the folks that you, when you're standing out in front of the abortion clinic, which you do, and I really want to talk about you, not Planned Parenthood. But the difference today is the folks that are working inside these clinics, the receptionists and those folks answering the phones, they're not there because they want to perpetuate genocide. The difference is Margaret Sanger and her donors, that was their goal.
Sure, and they had very much in common with the Chinese and the authoritarian countries that wanted to reduce the populations of their countries, and communists have often promoted abortion. Socialists and look how it's destroyed China.
Yeah, Margaret Sanger in the New Deal, Chris. Margaret Sanger in the New Deal tried to get that you needed a license to have a child.
Yeah. They wanted to restrict marriage licenses. They wanted to screen out people who could get married and who could have children. Sure.
So, Chris, can we change the I want to change the topic. First of all, I want to bring up something that is on your mind, I'm sure, quite a bit. Like, you are fighting cancer right now. You're in the middle of a brutal battle with cancer that, short of a miracle, you know, you've shared with me, you've been public about this, it's terminal. Your entire life, I want to talk about you, your entire adult life, I guess, going back to the early 80s, has been radically committed, not tepid in any way, radically committed to defending women. And with you, it's interesting. You're unique about a lot of the old-time pro-lifers. A lot of the old-time pro-lifers, you can look at them, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing. They're kind of like really obsessed with saving babies. And no one's probably saved more babies than you. I read that your organization has saved enough children that you could fill Madison Square Garden. That's cool.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
Yep.
And you'd probably want to fill it for a Bon Jovi concert. I don't know what you people in New York want to. What you would fill, if you'd invite them all there, it'd be for a Bon Jovi concert. So that's a lot of babies. But then putting that aside, what's interesting, and maybe you're going to say I'm wrong about this. In my mind, I have always thought Chris Slattery's a guy who's thinking about the moms first. Or really, you've had moms always top of mind in a movement that maybe for the longest time, it's been about protecting children from violence, which is not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing. But with you, I see this like profound empathy and commitment to protecting women from the violence of abortion. Do I have that wrong?
Yeah, no, that's true. And I got my start. What really a seminal moment for me was in the early 80s, probably 81 or 2, when I rescued a 15-year-old mother about to abort. Who her own mother was dragging her into an abortion clinic at then the largest abortion clinic in New York City called Park Med. And they were on Park Avenue. That's why they were called Park. And when I held that, I turned that 15-year-old and her mom around from an abortion plan, which they were about to get upstairs in this 50-story office building at Park Med. And I held that baby in my arms 6 months later. That 15-year-old mother, maybe she had turned 16, but I held that little baby in my arms and I looked at this mother and I said, this mother is going to influence, this was definitely at least 40 years ago. And this mother is going to influence the whole building. She's showing hope to the rest. Yeah, I'm a mother. You know, I'm very young. Maybe the Blessed Mother was 15 or 16 when she had Jesus. But I am going ahead. I'm going to be courageous. I'm living with my own mother, and I'm going to be a mother too. And I felt she was making a statement. She was taking a stand. She was being courageous. She was certainly able to do it because her own mother turned around with her together. I have no idea what I said to those women 40 years ago. I don't remember. But that was like one of the first time I ever did sidewalk counseling. And after I said to myself, well, Chris, you just helped save a life. And I said, yeah, wow, you can do this. You can actually, in this movement, if you can reach mothers, if you can get to them, You have the ability with persuasion, and then at that time I had nothing to offer her. I discovered at that time there were no pregnancy centers in New York City, and this was 10 years past the legalization of abortion in New York City. By the time I opened up my first pregnancy center and I signed a lease in 1984, a couple of years later, from this sidewalk counseling. We were the first pregnancy center in New York City, and we have been continually operating since 1985. in first in Manhattan, and we've been in the four main boroughs of New York City since that time. But we, although I grew up on Staten Island, we didn't go to Staten Island, which is the smallest of the five boroughs of New York by far. Yeah, so focus on the mother is the critical thing. And our battleground is really the mother. This is why we engage in sidewalk counseling. You get out there, you talk to women, you talk to the mother on her way into an abortion clinic. You talk to a mother who's contemplating abortion in a pregnancy center. These are the two spots that are most important in the pro-life movement, the counseling chair or the spot on the sidewalk. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where you engage. Now, you can engage in debates and schools at demonstrations, but you're just trying to change minds. You're not necessarily speaking to expectant mothers, you know, or fathers. You're not necessarily at a life or death decision. It's into intellectual argumentation. And, you know, the intellectual argumentation with mothers who are pregnant isn't really the main work. It's not about trying to persuade a woman about the humanity of the baby. She's interested in her own life, how motherhood's going to affect her, how her life is going to change. And she wants to know how I can manage this being a mother, or how I can arrange an adoption, which is not often seriously contemplated these days by women considering abortion. It is occasional that you'll see a mother turn to adoption as a solution. I had a couple of interesting stories of couples that we helped. One was a Muslim couple from Pakistan, but via South Africa. This couple had moved from South Africa, and I asked them why, and I guess they overstayed a visa and stayed illegally in New York, but they were discriminated against by the blacks of South Africa because they were the wrong skin color, but their skin was brown. I mean, it wasn't black.
Yeah, you know, so in South Africa, it's interesting. I think they are called, actually, in South Africa, they call them colored. So I think there's blacks, there's colored, or maybe it's unbelievable how we find ways to discriminate against each other and divide ourselves from each other. But yeah, it can be very nuanced.
With Mr. Khan, I found out what he did for a living. He was a body shop guy. He fixed cars. But he said he couldn't get a job because he didn't have any tools. So we went out to a used tool place and we bought all these weird looking tools to fix cars. You know, they're not your hammers and screwdrivers, your ordinary tool sets, all kinds of unusual tools that you bang out, you know, dents and or yank off fenders with, and or doors or whatever. So I enabled him and got him a bike, and then he rode around to all the body shops in Queens, and he found himself a job, and he had all his tools, because you needed the tools to get a job. You had to come with your own tools. So we basically got him, a sophisticated fishing rod so we could feed his family. And then they chose life. And then all of a sudden, a couple of years ago in 2019, I got this LinkedIn, which is this social media for more business oriented than Facebook, Twitter, and all that stuff. I got a message from this woman out of the blue. And she said to me, you don't know me, but I know who you are. You saved me from an abortion. And my parents told me about you. And you were kind of a hero to me. And I'm in college. I'm up in Massachusetts. And you should know that I'm pro-choice. But
you turned
me around. You turned my parents around, and and now she's working in business up there in Massachusetts, and then they were from Queens, New York. And so she out of the blue just found me out because she wanted to thank me.
It's so interesting too that she's pro-choice. She's grateful to you.
Yep.
Did you ever get to go out to lunch with her or?
No, I've yet to do that. It's on my bucket list of things to get done. And I have been doing a lot of bucket list things in this summer.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I want to get to some things. I want to, you said something that was very keen. You said where the rubber meets the road is at the abortion clinic or in the crisis pregnancy center. So we can debate in college campuses, which is very important because a lot of those girls will be in the position to make those decisions within that semester or that school year or in the next couple of years. So this is all very important. But the emotional weight and psychological stress and the intensity of the situation, right? And you know this, and I've experienced this too. You never know. A lot of what the other side says is true, right? So you're counseling a young woman, and you find out she was raped by her stepfather. Once Eduardo Verastegui and I were counseling a woman who was an illegal immigrant in Los Angeles who had a husband and children in Mexico. She was pro-life, a devout Catholic, but she'd been repeatedly and regularly raped at a bank where she was a cleaning lady by the bank manager. And she felt that if she went to the police, the manager told her they would arrest you for being illegal, not me. And so she was scared and she didn't want to lose her husband and her kids. And so she said this is a choice not between, I know it's a life, but it's a choice between losing my husband and my other children. And so you never know, right, when you're counseling, where it's going to go and what's going to be brought up and what you're going to find out. Now, you're in a point in life, brother, where the rubber is meeting the road. Your whole life, is your pro-life conviction, you're from the day when it was all Catholics, pretty much.
Right.
This emanate from your conviction as a Catholic, that you had an obligation to rescue the vulnerable?
I would say so, yeah. I probably could consider myself pro-choice, although I never did any abortion advocacy. No, I never did any abortion advocacy.
Okay.
But I was so apathetic. If you're apathetic toward abortion, you are in effect pro-choice.
Okay.
In other words, I don't care. If you don't care, then abortion's okay.
Mm-mm.
If you're not working against it, you're with the enemy. You're basically, you're promoting the status quo. Well, in most of the places where most of the abortions are done anyway. I know now that you can claim you live in a pro-life state in many states now.
Yeah, I can claim that.
That doesn't mean because you live in a pro-life state, you're pro-life.
True.
And women could still get abortions somewhere in states that are now where abortion is illegal. So I was kind of in that state of, I remember a conversation I had. I was a freshman at Boston College in 1973, the year that that September. I remember having a conversation with a priest, and this was like 9 months after abortion was legalized with Roe v. Wade nationwide. And he wanted to talk to me about abortion and how wrong it was. This was actually a Jesuit priest up at Boston College in 1973. I said, I don't really want to hear about it. I don't want to talk to you about that. And I thought back over the years, boy, I'm sure that man is deceased now, that priest, long deceased. As he was probably in his 50s or 60s in 1970s. Early 70s, and so I didn't ever get to tell him that I became a full-time pro-lifer. But I was so apathetic at Boston College, where I went in the early 70s, that I didn't even step into the chapel in that campus my years at the school. I did go to a cafeteria where they had a Saturday night mass because they had free donuts afterwards and coffee. So I would occasionally go to the Saturday night mass. Once I went to a Saturday night mass there, I was so drunk that I went behind the curtains on a ledge and fell asleep and woke up at 2 or 3 in the morning. And all the doors to the building were locked. I was locked into the student center. And I kind of opened a window, one of these small windows, and fell off a ledge about 7 or 8 feet above the ground and twisted my ankle and limped home at 2 or 3 in the morning to my dorm. But, you know, so I was a bit of a rogue and pro choice and I did my...
Now,
my share of
when
spinning.
You were in school, 1973, I was 2. I mean, we didn't have what... I mean, there was the Time Life photographs from the 60s that were striking of the child in the womb. Would you have just thought, did you buy the old line, it was like a grain of sand and a teaspoon of blood? Or would you? Did you have this sort of radical bodily autonomy argument?
Wasn't thinking of... I just didn't want to think about it. I was thinking about the Vietnam War and finishing that. Those protests off, and I was thinking about hunger and walks for hunger and stuff like this, and I just was into more liberal causes that were not abortion related. I didn't know anybody in the pro-life movement that didn't have any interest in that stuff. I started an outdoor club. I get people into the mountains. I started a student management consulting group for small businesses. I was into the theater. I was a manager of the basketball team, varsity. We went to the NIT at the Garden. I was into other stuff.
You know? Well, what's interesting is, I mean, when you look at the old school pro-lifers like you, like Congressman Chris Smith, and his wife, Marie Smith, and I'm sure you guys are friends going way back, that they were all kind of coming from the left. You had the Black Panthers out in front of abortion clinics. When you started in the pro-life movement, was it seen as something that, like, Democrat Catholics did? Or was it already kind of shifting to politically? Because then I would say that most of the pro-life vote up until Reagan was living on the Democrat Party.
Well, look, I didn't really know anybody, and there wasn't really a pro-life movement in New York City when I started. I mean, there was a Manhattan Right to Life office with a nurse, part-time nurse. I mean, a nurse who was part-time with the pro-life office she had. That was about it, and they didn't do too much. I mean, I only encountered other pro-lifers when I went to the March for Life, my first big pro-life activity in 1980.
So would you have identified, were you a registered Democrat in those days when you were doing these pro-life?
I was. I voted for Jimmy Carter the first time against Ronald Reagan. And then I had my conversion to both, I would say, towards common sense conservatism and to pro-life. When I came back to my Catholic faith, I realized that I'd been a great sinner and a great idiot. And I woke up to how the radical Democrat Party of the New York was very rapidly pro-abortion, how the city was gripped with this abortion fever. In the early days, in 1970, I discovered there were a quarter of a million abortions a year, like in New York City in 71 and 2. We legalized July 1st, 1970 in the state. And, you know, people flocked to New York from all over the country. In the last few weeks, I've been getting calls from all over the country as people are telling me, well, I can't get a late-term abortion now in Florida. There was a woman that was 17 weeks. I got her in touch with a pregnancy center in Miami. There was a woman in Indiana said, I can't get an abortion now. Can I come to New York? I put her in touch with the pregnancy center in Columbus. There was somebody in Wisconsin. I'm not pretty sure they could still get abortions in Wisconsin. Anyway, I put her in touch with the pregnancy center in Madison. And there was somebody in Columbus, Ohio, put her in touch with Heartbeat in Columbus. So like in the early days where people were flooding all over the country to New York, it's getting like that again. People are coming to New York for abortions. Anyway, for me,
well, this is important. So real quick, so we're seeing things kind of, the train comes through the tunnel in the direction that it left. So what we saw in the early days, and I believe in 10 years, 15 years, from sea to shining sea, the child will be protected from violence from biological beginning. It's going to be a bumpy, probably couple of years ahead of us, but I think this is just where we are headed. And so now you're seeing in New York City what you saw in your early days, that people literally jumped on a Greyhound bus or on an airplane to go to New York City because they know that they knew they can get an abortion there.
Right. Yeah. It's getting like that again.
So expect the mother care is going to have a lot more stress. So that's something I'd never really thought about, that in those blue states, especially cities like Chicago, New York City, Los Angeles, the pro-life movement, the pregnancy center networks in those cities are going to be under an immense strain. So then we nationally have to really be mobilized and begin to be prepared to support pregnancy centers, not just in our own community, but to support pregnancy centers and sort of what are beginning to become sort of the abortion capitals of the world. And New York City is the abortion capital of the United States,
That's
no doubt.
Right. Yeah. But we're getting attacked from all angles now. City, state, and federal political attacks, and attacks from social media and Google. We are being hit with investigations at the city, state, and federal level of pregnancy centers. We have seen in recent weeks, Google is trying to deplatform pregnancy centers and cripple our advertising efforts to reach women.
We need to launch investigations in companies like Google once we take back the House. And there needs to be severe penalties.
Well,
this is absolutely unbelievable. And
so we are being deplatformed so that we're seeing actually calls down in pregnancy centers across the country, because we've gotten to the point where every woman is solving every problem, every man too. Just Google it. Anything she wants, everything he wants, everybody just Googles or says Siri, you know, in effect asking for help through Google. And when pregnancy centers are being stopped from coming up on search engine results, when abortion keyword terms are searched, this is hurting our ability to gain access to women. So we're coming with end-run strategies. We're going to have to start advertising on apps of all kinds and find women on their favorite app instead of through the Google search mechanisms. And this is expensive. This is complicated. And it's beyond the sophisticated of the system. Sophistication of the average pregnancy center to do this stuff. I mean, in the old days, we would just place a once a year ad in the elevator and we'd be done with our ad campaign.
You know? You'd maybe put some signs up in buses, things like that.
Yeah, we did subway advertising. We did transit. I did aerial advertising over beaches. I did movie theater ads. I did radio ads. Never did television ads, too expensive. But I've tried everything to get women into our centers, but nothing has worked as smoothly and as beautifully as Google keyword ads. But now it's being crippled. I'm in the throes of a crisis with this and about to transition to new types of advertising outreach using apps.
I mean, this is your guy
Google
that started out in the early 80s, standing in front of skyscrapers where there were abortion mills in the top of the skyscrapers. And now here you are. What year were you born?
I was born in 1955.
So here you are.
And the same year that McDonald's was established as a company.
Well, there you have it.
They've grown a few more outlets than I have.
So how How old were you when you had your first McDonald's hamburger?
Who knows?
Do you remember? I remember my first McDonald's hamburger.
No, I don't remember. I don't honestly remember, but
Chris, do you remember this?
The arches, golden arches.
Do you remember when McDonald's were kind of cowboy themed on the inside?
A little bit, yeah.
Remember that? That's how it was in the early 70s. I was probably 3. And I remember just the mustard and the pickle to me was like magic. Like, what is this? It was this hamburger. And they didn't open until like 11 or noon. They didn't have breakfast yet. I remember when the McDonald's in our neighborhood got breakfast and then you had an Egg McMuffin. And sure. And you were just like, what is this? This is unbelievable, this Egg McMuffin thing. And but no, I went to McDonald's. When I first went to it, it was only for it was not open for breakfast. And they had like cowboy themes. And they all had, and you usually only went to McDonald's. I don't know why we're talking about this, but you usually only went to McDonald's for birthday parties. It was something very special. Yeah. It wasn't like
Arby's was Roy Rogers' chain, and he was the real cowboy. They were certainly with the roast beef sandwiches. They were more themed towards the cowboys. He would have he was on pictures on horses and everything.
So Arby's was a Roy Rogers franchise?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Have you ever had a Roy Rogers chicken, been to a Roy Rogers chicken place?
Well, they serve chicken at the Roy Rogers as well as roast beef sandwiches.
Yeah, they were good.
I love Arby's. I love A&W root beer places too.
So I did not know that Arby's is the same staff. So it's the same thing, just rebranded?
No, I think it was always called Arby's.
Okay, no, but I've been to Roy restaurants called Roy Rogers.
Oh yeah,
like Roy Rogers.
Maybe I'm mixing it up.
So here you were born the same year that McDonald's was started, and then that's the real McDonald's. That's before Ray Kroc was involved. I don't even know.
No. That's when Ray Kroc took it over.
So that's when Ray Kroc took it over, and
bought it from the brothers, McDonald's brothers,
for like $1 million. What a deal! And so you've
been
there's
that movie where he screwed them, you know.
Well, that movie, let's digress for a second. That movie to me is, I think everyone misses the point. Maybe even the writer and director. To me, what I got from that movie is the winners in life were the McDonald's brothers. And Ray Kroc was the loser. Because Ray Kroc, first of all, he took his wife from his friend.
He was a bit of a swindler.
He was a swindler. He lived a miserable life. Was not a Christian. I think his wife became Salvation Army later in life. I don't know. Or maybe she wasn't even, but she just gave him all their money. Don't know if he had a family. But what I got from the, I don't know if he had children. But what I got from the McDonald's brothers were they had very modest goals. I think they wanted to make $1 million each. And they got that from Ray Kroc. And they were happy. And then I saw a documentary on them. They lived beautiful, simple, it's very simple, beautiful lives, where they were involved in the life of their children. They got along with their spouse. I'm like, these guys were the winners. And Ray Kroc is the big loser.
We can get very ambitious. There are a lot of big pro-life organizations with many chapters and many multi-million-dollar operations and pregnancy centers that have grown to many locations, not so much in New York City. And you can get very, very, very big salaries. You can get very big jobs. And we also can, those in the pro-life movement, we can get overly ambitious too. I'm not saying we're swindlers. Maybe Planned Parenthood would call us such, but
We always have to be careful, right? When you're serving the vulnerable, you have to remember who you're serving. Doesn't mean you should have to be on food stamps to work at a pregnancy center, but it just means that we have to be very careful because people trust us. And when you're standing next to the most vulnerable people in the world, I just heard that Joe Biden's cancer research organization gave $0 in grants, and that all the money, 98% of the money went to salaries or something like that. I want to know what the other 2% went to, like a mailbox and a phone. I don't even know. But no, you have
to
be.
This is the group he was associated with?
Yeah, no, he founded this cancer moonshot cancer organization that was just a total boondoggle. And you know, now that's one extreme end, but there's lots of degrees. So, you know, between
no wonder he's promoting the end to cancer.
Yeah, no, exactly.
We'll end cancer by election day.
Moonshot. No, and I love how he always uses this line. And I give you my word as a Biden. Like, brother, I saw your son beating a prostitute on camera, and he filmed it himself, brother. That's a weird expression. I give you my name as a Biden. I'd come up with a new catchphrase, my friend.
I'm not worth a lot.
So, brother, I want to ask you this. So your whole life has been about promoting human life. I did not know you started out sort of in the like left-leaning Catholic social justice area.
I was actually a subscriber to Progressive magazine.
Well, here you have it. And you were one of the first
magazines I subscribed to.
And you were a big shot in the advertising world. You worked for Economist magazine. I think who else did you work? You worked for Financial
Doyle
Times
Dean
of London.
Doyle Dean Burnback.
Yeah, so here you were
Bill Burnback. I actually got to know him. He was one of the big geniuses in the ad business. And we had American Airlines account and IBM. He handled Volkswagen at one earlier stage before I joined his firm.
When did you... Here you are, this progressive Catholic, anti-war activist, fighting for poverty programs. When did you realize that your work as a pro-life advocate was pushing you outside of polite society? When did that dawn? When did you realize, marginalized myself?
In 1987 was a seminal year. In January, I was coming back from the March for Life on the Staten Island Ferry at State with before I got married, the cousin of my future wife, of my fiance. And then I was taking a ferry into the city because we had driven down round trip to the March for Life, and I'm opening up the New York Times on the Staten Island Ferry, and I'm seeing a picture of a press conference by Robert Abrams and the head of Planned Parenthood and NARAL, National Abortion Rights Action League in New York City, targeting my pregnancy center for a lawsuit and subpoenas. And then that year, a few months after that, I met Randall Terry, who would become the founder of Operation Rescue.
And what year was this?
He was organized.
What year was this?
This was 1987.
Wow.
So he, on some Saturday afternoon in 1987, right about the time Robert Abrams, the New York State Attorney General, was targeting me, he's waiting downstairs, and a colleague of his is coming upstairs to ask questions about scheduling an abortion for his girlfriend, which was bogus. He was just trying to test us and see, did we in fact do abortions? They were convinced we were an abortion clinic, and he and Randall were looking for targets. They thought our pregnancy center was an abortion clinic. So I became good friend. I told this guy, you're lying to me. You're not really looking for an abortion. You don't really mean it. And I was right. And my wife, also got involved with me. In 87, we would get married that year, that May. So we were engaged at that point, but we were meeting with Randall Terry, and we started recruiting people to blockade abortion clinics. So long story, in answer to this question is, getting arrested in 1988 and then getting publicity and then getting New York Magazine to do a story on me, 3-page story with a full page picture of my wife and I with our newborn baby. And this was like 88 or 89. with our newborn baby, Mary Frances. Yeah, that would have been 89, in my lap, sitting on an examining room table where we did the ultrasound. Yeah, I got exposed as a pro-lifer in public in a big way in this important weekly magazine of New York City. And this was when I started to get blackballed by people in the ad business. But eventually I would stay in it until 1990 when I got fired. I had really gone over the edge, and I got multiple arrests and multiple television appearances leading Operation Rescue. And I got hit with a big lawsuit, Now versus Terry it was called, and I was a defendant along with Dr. Bernard Nathanson. That's another story. And Randall Terry and a bunch of other pro-life leaders who we co-organized Operation Rescue. And this was served on me in my last big advertising job at another business magazine I worked for. And so I got fired on St. Patrick's Day, March 1990. And after I got fired that night, I decided I was going full-time with the pro-life movement. Wow. And that summer I did. I went full-time in 1990 after having, you know, basically been fired. One thing they had done, the pro boards put up wanted posters for me all over Manhattan. They took the magazine picture of me from New York Magazine, and they printed it in black and white with a wanted on the top: operator of fake abortion clinic, leader of Operation Rescue, enemy of women. And some woman in the office I worked in with 50 employees would put this up in the women's stalls, in all the women's stalls in the bathrooms. My picture, wanted, enemy of women. So, man, did I get a cold shoulder.
Now, how did you take that? Like, people you cared about, you liked, you smiled, you shared cake with, with Susie's birthday in the break room. Like, how does it feel? Like, that's one thing people don't understand that aren't activists. No one likes to be misunderstood and hated. No one likes to be ostracized.
There was a woman who was friendly to me in the office, and she showed me the poster, and then the posters were plastered all over Manhattan. They were on mailboxes and lampposts. And
how did you deal with that? You're in your early 30s. You got a wife and a daughter.
And telephone poles. And yeah, and that, by that time I had two kids, another one on the way.
How did you feel? I mean, what was it like?
It was stressful. I mean, I had a very good paying job. My last paying job back in 1990, I was making $75,000 a year. Now I had started.
I was making 1990 in the infantry. I was making $8,000 a year.
In 1978,
you were doing pretty good.
I was making $7,500 a year, which was not a lot.
$7,500 or $75,000?
My first job, $7,500 a year, my first advertising job. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically what I was making the industry. So, and you liked it, obviously. You loved the industry.
Yeah, I stayed in it, but I did very well. You know, I had risen up and I was making a great salary, and then I get fired and I'm going, oh my God. To go full-time pro-life, I took a huge pay cut. I was basically went to a $24,000 a year salary when I started working, running my own show and raising my own money for myself.
So well, you're pretty good at it. You're pretty aggressive. I mean, Chris Slattery's known as a pretty...
Well, I had to learn fundraising. It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody when I moved to Manhattan.
Now Manhattan is, there's actually a lot of very committed pro-life sentiment in New York City, and I think that would surprise a lot of folks.
Yeah, there are, but...
And you are a hero. I mean, you are a hero.
Many live in the suburb.
You are a hero of the pro-life movement, but I would say that in New York City, you know, you're greatly admired and known. And you somehow remained, I mean, I do think people like you. In New York, you're a fixture of New York City.
Yeah.
Right? You would agree with that.
Yes.
And people like you.
But it took time to make all the connections over, you know.
But are you even liked by the other side? There's something about your personality, which isn't.
I don't know.
I wouldn't say that you're winsome. Like, you don't have a winsome personality, but you're loved. Well, and everyone likes Chris Slattery, but you're a tough nut. You're a tough guy.
Well.
And you don't ever give anybody a quarter. You don't give a quarter. But yet I believe that people like you. And when I've been in New York City, it just seems like your name is known. Like, I'm known in Honolulu and Hawaii. I'm known, but it's Honolulu.
Sure.
And even people who are pro-life go, I like that guy. I know I disagree with them. That's what's great about community. And I feel like in New York, it's the same way. Like, I disagree with this Chris Slattery guy, but, he's a good guy. I like the guy. Is that kind of fair to say that you're like?
Well, with the pro aborts, the engagement between the pro-lifers and pro-aborts are the most radical fringe of the pro-aborts are on.
In New York City.
Yeah, they don't like any of us. They hate us. They detest us. But I don't engage with those people. I mean, it's a whole new generation.
It's different.
That knew me from from the 80s and the 90s with Operation Rescue. That was a whole different crowd. The crowd today are radical anarchists, socialists, Marxists.
Yeah, you know what? I wish they were even Marxist. I was just talking to a buddy of mine. We had a meeting on the Vulnerable People Project, our work, and we're like, guys, there's a need to greatly amplify our reach and our work, and we want to be known as sort of the conservative instrument for human rights work, because there are no more advocates for human rights. You know, before the Marxist, the groups, the human rights organizations in the 70s and 80s Amnesty International was founded by a Jesuit, but let's be real, it was kind of more grounded in Marxism. There were a lot of these human rights groups that were kind of grounded in Marxist theory, but there was something authentic and sincere about them. And I missed them. And now these groups, like you said, this new breed, they're not even Marxist. They're nihilists. There's like nothing, there's no there but hatred. Right? You could see a young farmer in Nicaragua being attracted to Marxism in 1978. Like, I get this. And I could see how they would win sympathy from young Catholic school kids like you who are subscribing to Progressive Magazine.
Yeah.
Like, I get all of that. But these young leftists are selfish, hateful, nihilists.
Oh, yeah.
And there is absolutely no thoughtfulness to human suffering, reducing human suffering, concern for the vulnerable. It's all ego-driven, very weird stuff. And no one probably sees that better than you on the streets of New York City.
Well, in July, I saw one of the nastiest crowds I've ever seen. We've had for some years a Witness for Life. It's a mass and procession to Planned Parenthood in Lower Manhattan, on either side of Houston Street. Below Houston is where the old St. Patrick's Cathedral is located, and just north of Houston is where the Planned Parenthood is on Mott Street. So the pro-aborts have blockading the procession. In August and September, the police didn't want to deal with it anymore, and they basically said, break up the procession, please, and walk over in ones and twos. And then this month, September, they said, just don't even go over there for us. Long story short was the cops literally pushed this group of pro-aborts, 200 of them, that were pressing against the cops as they moved them inch by inch, an hour and a half for a 5-minute walk. They moved in, the cops moved in front of us to push slowly with just their hands, no riot gear, no shields, no nothing, just their hands. They pushed the crowd a 10 across, a block and a half. It took them an hour and a half. It just wore the cops out, And they don't want to do that every single month.
No.
They've been trying to discourage us from doing these processions. But these people, they've got communist banners, socialist banners, workers' party banners. They're calling for the end of the U.S. Supreme Court, the end of the U.S. government. They're just complete radical communists.
And who've never been hungry.
1920s.
Who have never worked a long day in their life. They've never been hungry. There was a great Babylon Bee article that said, young woke activists disturbed to learn that hammer and sickle are actually symbols of manual labor. what are these people upset about? They're not. I have an article coming out. I don't know if you saw Dr. Phil's little battle with Lila Rose. It was so I commend Lila for not punching Dr. Phil in the face, but he just pretends not to know when human life begins. It's like this unknowable mystery when life begins, which of course he's lying. And it, to me, was a moment of clarity. It was actually that which decided that I got my team on the call and said, we need to get bigger. Because what I saw with Dr. Phil is it says it all. We don't care. We all know that our laptops are made by Uyghur slaves. We all know that electric cars destroy the planet, are toxic, and the rare earth minerals that go into making those batteries are literally mined by black African children working, 14-hour days in the hot sun. We all know that. We all know that. So it's these people just don't really care, and they're maniacs. And they have to be addressed. They're not, they call themselves communists or Marxists. That means nothing to them. They're not sitting around reading Karl Marx. They're on Tinder or Grindr or whatever they're on. They're addled with entertainment. They've never known hunger. They've never known hardship. They have known a type of hardship, which is, the breakdown of the American family, godlessness, nihilism, in a way that I have pity for them. But they have never known, like, what it's like to work a 20-hour day. They've never missed a meal. But they want to burn it all down, man. Let's burn it all down.
Their criticism, their attack is always calling us fascists.
Yes.
Now, I had posters against me in the 1980s and calling me an enemy of women. And they recently put posters all around the streets in Brooklyn calling me an evangelical fascist. Slattery is an evangelical fascist who runs a fake clinic.
What upsets you more? What upsets you more? What upsets you more? That they called you a fascist?
I don't mind being called an evangelical, even though I'm a Catholic.
Okay.
I don't like being called a fascist.
No.
But that's exactly what these people do. They call you what they are.
That's true.
They're the fascists, and they try to use that against us.
And look, Chris, if I disagreed with you, if I was adamantly committed to abortion, and I would look at a man like you, Chris Slattery, and I'd say, I disagree with this guy. I feel sorry for him. He believes this myth that his grandparents and his parents passed down to him, this Catholic thing. And I really pity him that he's, believes this silly fairy tale and that he's, I disagree with him. I believe in radical bodily autonomy for women. Obviously, I don't respect anyone that says they don't know when life begins. But I do get an atheist saying that yes, it's a life, but blah, 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 women have competing rights. I will give him that. And if I was a pro abort, I would say, listen, Chris Slattery is a guy, as wrongheaded as he is, that through great personal sacrifice of himself has worked to serve women as he knew how, even though he's wrongheaded. And the fact that they lack the ability, the way that I used to go to the abortion clinic and see the death squirts and the abortionists walk in, and I would kind of admire them. I would talk to them, and I really believed that when I was standing across from a death squirt in 1995, they were there because they really wanted to help women. I felt that. And I used to tell them, the line I used to say to them is, what you and I have in common? Nobody in this town cares more about women than we do. We're just disagreeing on some of the facts. We're both willing to be hated by half the people who know us. We're both willing to come out here and on a Saturday, instead of doing going antiquing or going to wine bars, we're here. And we're radically committed to women. I do not see that on the other side anymore. I look for it. I do. I really try to find it, and I look for it, and I just don't see it. I just see seething hatred grounded in nothingness.
Yeah. And I've seen this. I mean, I know this exists in other cities. We've seen, for instance, in the intensity of the militant violent left in Seattle and Portland. But you have this in New York City as well. I mean, you've always had a very radical element here, but you've got that also in San Francisco and Austin, Texas. And
where are these people? Right? Like when I walk around New York City, I love New York City. I used to think I hated New York. You are partly, you are, you are Chris Slattery, the reason why I love New York City. Do you know that?
Oh, really?
No, let me tell you why.
Tell the story of how we bumped into each other on 6th Avenue.
We have bumped into each other in the strangest places, yes. So I'll tell you how we first met. So we first met, I'm running the marketing for Bella. I just left, Brownback was running for president. He came in third in the Iowa straw poll. I knew the campaign would eventually wind up. So I resigned, and I went to run the marketing for Bella because we got a distribution deal. We were coming out that November. So this was August. So I don't know who gave me your number, or you called me. Did I call you, or did you call me?
I think I called you.
Who gave you my number?
I guess I heard about Bella from the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal, who I knew.
Okay. So I get,
I don't remember the details. All I know is I mostly was dealing with you on the phone, and we went at it, you know. We were going at it over, you didn't believe, you thought I was a bullshit artist.
You're never going to pull off all of this stuff,
given these moot tickets away. I kept saying, give me more tickets.
You were very demanding. Yeah, so what happened is we ended up getting $500,000 from Goya Foods to buy tickets.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to get buses going from public schools directly to the theater. I'm going to get Bronxville High School. And I'm like, my wife went to Bronxville High School. I'm going to get Bronxville High School kids bus directly to the movie theater. And I'm just like, this guy's full of it. I remember telling some of my team, just like I did today, by the way, in Afghanistan. This woman is just, I told my staff, she is so full of it. I said, but have her write a proposal. Let's burden her. Just give her work to work. Let's punish her for wasting our time by giving her work. So I was kind of doing that to you. I was like, this guy isn't going to do any of this. But I was like giving you tasks. You know, I was like, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you put signs up? Can you put Bella signs up at this place? But you were, and then you were doing all of that. And maybe this guy, nah, no way, no way. And at the end of the day, I don't know how many tickets you gave away, an immense amount.
I think it was like 50,000.
Yeah, $50,000 in tickets or 50,000 tickets. I ended up, because of Goya Foods, working with these Spanish language radio stations. We were doing ticket giveaways. So for 2 weeks, I was in front of the movie theater on 42nd Street, I believe.
Yeah, the biggest theater in the country, AMC Empire 25.
That was it.
25 screens.
And I'll tell you what was great about it. I had to give out tickets, and I was there from the first showing at 10 a.m. to the last showing at midnight. The last showing, we would fill the theater at midnight with the homeless. And that was some of the most profound experiences, where they would be crying to me saying how they felt like they can be forgiven for their crimes. It was just unbelievable. And but, you know, that's where I got to learn. Like, guys like you, I think, are obnoxious. I thought your whole city was obnoxious. I thought this city, they're all crazy people. And then, but after 2 weeks of living on the streets of New York from 10 a.m. till midnight, actually, because no, we would stay until the show ended. So it'd be till 2 in the morning. So from 10 a.m. till 2 in the morning for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. It was a long time. It's forever. And we would be giving out tickets at the Whitestone Theater, which I loved that theater, and the 42nd Street Theater, then the other theater over by NYU. And so we're just running around the city, giving away tickets. I'm speaking at churches in all the boroughs, these historic, beautiful Protestant churches. I just fell in love with New Yorkers. And that was really because of you and Goya Foods. I had to live on the streets in New York, and I had to visit. And I mean, I was speaking nonstop. Like I had a black car.
Yeah. And I think many of your listeners to this program, they may not have seen the movie Bella.
True.
But you can see. Can you get this on Netflix or Amazon Prime?
You can definitely get it on Amazon. If it's on Prime right now for free, I don't know. But you know how it is. On all the different apps, like on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, it's free sometimes and sometimes it's not. It's something you should all just own. It's a classic movie. It's the first movie in Hollywood history where the star is Mexican, where it's the hero is a Mexican-American. And it's just a very special, beautiful film. We won the Toronto International Film Festival, and it was a real privilege to be a part of it. And that was something I didn't expect. I was obviously involved in the project because it was pro-life. It's just a story, but the truth is, like, we can't run from it. the story exemplifies the beauty and dignity and courage of women choosing life. And but that's what I saw in it. But what the Mexican community saw, the Latino community broadly saw, was for the first time ever on the big screen, their family celebrated. Just the
Oh yeah, Bella can be seen with ads for free on Amazon Prime.
Boom.
Where you can rent it with no ads for $3.99.
I'm so privileged to be a part of this film. I was just talking to, well, actually, Alejandro Monteverdi left me a message yesterday. He
said, was the executive producer, wasn't he?
No, he was the writer-director. And Alejandro Monteverdi, and he messaged me yesterday. He's just finished he's finishing up a film now in Mother Cabrini, and he said it's the best film he ever made. But because of you, I fell in love with New Yorkers. I love New York to this day. And when you see these rabid leftist mobs, I know I talk to them at the Starbucks. I know I see them at the restaurant. They're my waiter. You see them at the bookstore, and I love them. They're kooky. They're pierced up. They're wackadoos. What happens to them when they get in the mob? Like, what happens to them? I was just reading Credo today with my son, who's 16, Plato's Credo, and it talks about how, you know, the mob lacks all wisdom. They just ignore whatever the mob says, just whatever. Shrug it off, Socrates says. But, you know, when you look at these crowds of wackadoodle New Yorkers who are spitting in your face, putting up Chris Slattery as a fascist, there's something unique about New Yorkers. They're a New Yorker, you're a New Yorker. I mean, does it bother you? Like, wow, these are my people. And
Yeah. I mean, I've always been tempted to leave New York. You know, I'm on Social Security. I have an income. I have a house that I could sell and get out of town. And, you know, I've got my terminal cancer. But you know what? I can't abandon this city. I can't abandon New York. I can't abandon the mothers and the children who need to be seen in the same building as Planned Parenthood, to be retrieved, to be rescued, literally out of the clutches of the dark Planned Parenthood. You know, we New Yorkers, we love intensely, we hate intensely, we are intense people. I talk to on average 20 abortion determined women a day on the phone. Well, up until recently, until we had Google cut our legs off, but we're going to hobble back soon with advertising on apps. But we're intense. But we have so much to offer in terms of music, culture, museums, parks. It's a great city and great people. You got to be tough to live in New York. You got to be a little crazy to live in New York. You got to be a little crazy to stay here with all what we're going through now.
Yeah, you guys are going through a lot. Well, I remember you and I were arguing when we first met. You didn't believe me when I told you I was going to get you all those tickets. Right?
No.
I didn't believe you.
I don't remember.
No, yeah. You're like, I got 12 more schools, or I got 12 more classes, I got 12 more buses. And I'm like, I don't believe you. You're like, I don't believe you can get me more tickets. I'm like, I can get you more tickets, but brother, you got to make sure there are butts and seats. I promised Goya Foods. I promised the owner of Goya Foods, for every dollar he gave me, for every ticket he buys, there'll be a butt in the seat. And what he said, man, God bless this guy. He's like, I'm going to give you $500,000. And I kind of was quiet about how much Goya did for us, but then they came out for Trump and I'm like, I could say whatever about Goya. They're out and about now, but they bought $500,000 in tickets because they love the pro-life message and they love the pro-Latino message. And that's their audience. And so you didn't believe me. You probably don't remember, but I'm like, I can get you good $50,000 in ticket, whatever you need, I can get you. And you didn't believe me that I could get the tickets. I didn't believe you that you could distribute the tickets. And you distributed more tickets for us than anyone in the United States. Period. Really? End of story. No doubt. Yeah. And definitely you were the only one that had public school buses going from public schools to movie theaters. No one else pulled that off. But you talk about how we've run into each other. Like, it's bizarre. One time I'm on my way to Darfur, Sudan, in the height of the genocide. My flight was delayed like 20 hours. So I got a hotel. I went from the airport.
You were flying out of JFK, of course.
Yeah, I'm flying out.
You came back into Manhattan.
Yes. And what I did was I took the opportunity of my delayed flight to like repack my luggage to make more room. And I made more room because I wanted to bring more Bibles because I'm going to Darfur, to a persecuted Christian community in the height of the genocide. And I look at my clock and it's like, okay, it's like 9:32 in my hotel. And it's
at
like
night
or whatever time it was. Yeah, because you were standing out in the middle of the street. This is the nighttime.
I was trying to get a ticket for a debate with Ann Coulter and somebody else, some liberal.
I remember it was Ann Coulter and Bill Maher.
Oh right.
Yeah,
and so, I didn't have a ticket. I was in front of Radio City Music Hall,
standing in the middle of the street, and I'm running, and you're like, Jason. I'm like, Chris, what? Like, what are you doing here? And we couldn't even talk. I said, listen, Barnes and Noble's is closing. It's closing in 12 minutes. I got to go buy more Bibles. And I literally ran, scooped up a bunch of Bibles. So we didn't even say hi. It was like, eh. And then the other time I'm in Rome at a side altar at a church, San Andrea della Frate, down by the Spanish Steps. And I'm kneeling down praying. I didn't even look to my left. I didn't even look, but eventually I looked to my left and you just smiled at me. You're like, hi, what are you doing here? That was wild. That was a wild experience. So I promised you only an hour, but I want to end on this, Chris, you know, because earlier you talked about where the rubber meets the road. Is it the crisis pregnancy center where you have this emotion, you have the weight of the decision that's weighing on both of you, you as a counselor, the young woman who's there. You are now at a point where the rubber meets the road as a human being. We're all going to be there one day. I just had a biopsy on my face this week. By God's grace, it was benign. You were given...
You had some growth.
Yeah, I told the doctor, I said, listen, you can put cause of death already in my death certificate, skin cancer. Just the date is up for grabs, you know, because I'm very pasty.
But you didn't have it.
Translucent, lived in Hawaii for 31 years, always out in the sun. Yeah. So, but this time we're good. How has, like, when you received the terminal cancer diagnosis, like, how did that impact your faith? Like, what was the first thing you thought of when you were given that diagnosis?
Well, keep fighting for it, the life of mothers and their children, and until the last breath I have, I cannot lighten up. I'm not saying that I haven't done a little more extra travel. I've been doing some bucket list stuff and trying to incorporate some of my long-term lifetime goals. One of those is to drive a motorcycle. I go for a motorcycle lessons this weekend in upstate New York. I just did 11 national parks this summer and three different trips. One was on the trip I met you at last. That was in Naples. And I actually, didn't I also see you in Napa?
Not this year. Yeah, but last year.
Okay.
And
but I saw you in Naples at the LifeSite.
We were with Jim Caviezel.
I went over to Everglades National Park, and I went to the Dry Tortugas, most inaccessible national park. It's a 5.5-hour round trip ferry ride from Key West, which is way the heck out there.
Wow.
And so when I just came back from last week, I went to national parks of Grand Teton, Yellowstone, and Glacier National Park on the Canadian border in Montana. So I've been doing some things with nature. I've been walking through parks. I've been going to zoos. I've been getting close to the animals and the bison in Montana and Wyoming. And yesterday I went to the Bronx Zoo to look at the bison in the Bronx Zoo. And I'm still working the phones. I'm still working my fundraising. I'm still, but I'm, you know, I'm looking at a little more nature. Some of the things that I've not spent the time to appreciate so much at my fast paced New York lifestyle, tried to do some things I've always wanted to do, you know, hit some of these great national parks, ride a motorcycle, going up to Troy, New York to do that this weekend. And the reason is they have these programs where you can get a license without even having to take the motor vehicle test. If you take this training and you pass the training, you get the license. So, I mean, there's some crazy things I've always wanted to do, you know, go to these fantastic signs of God's greatness, God's magnificence. I mean, you go to our national parks and you go to zoos and you check out all the exotic animals. And I mean, you realize, oh my Lord, these are God's gifts to the world. Let's appreciate them. Babies and mothers are probably the most beautiful thing to behold, but there are other great things.
And you see those at the zoo, though, don't you? Think about it. When you go to the zoo, you're seeing a lot of babies, a lot of little kids, a lot of moms, grandmas, and these beautiful creatures. It's interesting, isn't it, that early in our life...
Well, you see species that are near extinct or endangered, and you realize they're just like our unborn children, who in some places are endangered, and with a replacement level of population below replacement, you know, we're human beings are at great risk of dying off in many countries through demographic winter.
Look, you have Bill Maher, the liberal that you saw wanted to see debate Ann Coulter, who's been going out there saying, listen, at the decline with the sperm count, the way it's decreasing every year, by the year 2040, they say it'll be zero for the average male. And Bill Maher is like, does this not concern people more than global warming? Have we lost our minds? Are we thoughtless to our posterity? But isn't that the selfishness of the new left? The old left, even the Marxist left, was about equity and justice for people that were poor and for our posterity. And obviously there's a lot we had to disagree with the Marxists of the old left. But who knew there was so much we agreed with them upon, right? Like concern for human beings. We actually concerned about, we were really concerned about human beings. And with the new left, there's absolutely no concern for human beings.
Yeah, they're more concerned for electric batteries, for cars, without any consideration of how it damages the earth and slave labor is used to create these batteries from mining of precious minerals. There's no thought about the idea of the damage they're doing to the environment and people by foisting these electric cars on us. It's just insane. There's no thought about the human element to it.
No. How did the diagnosis impact your like prayer life?
So I've, you know, tried to live total abandonment to God, but not trying to hide this thing. It's kind of when you go bald and you lose your hair and, you know, you don't want to have to try and make up all these excuses to people. You have to tell people what you're going through. And so I've been asking people, many, many people, asking them for prayers. And it's a great time to be an example of how terminal disease is a time for people to get closer to God, which I'm trying to do, trying to get closer to nature, trying to appreciate all the God that God's created. I try to appreciate my friends more, trying to do more time with friends, time with nature, a little less intensity, all at the same time, while the pro-life movement is under incredible attack in the blue states, like New York, we're being attacked by the city of New York, the state of New York, the federal government, coming after pregnancy centers, smear campaigns, constant detraction of our work in the public, in the media, and in campaigns to investigate us, kind of like what the Trump campaign has gone through, the Trump family.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing. They're not shy about weaponizing the state against their political enemies, are they?
No, no. And I mean, I was just talking with an hour and a half with my attorneys today. We've got a New York State Department of Health investigation coming down on all the pregnancy centers in our state. The city of New York is going to have a nasty publicity campaign against the pregnancy centers in New York City, focused on me. No doubt. You can't let up. You cannot like retire. You can't go off to retirement in Florida. I've got to be an example to those that take over for me. You've got to fight. You've got to continue to advocate for the mothers and the children and not close your pregnancy centers. You can't. I can't do it. I got to stay open as long as I possibly can. I need support from across America. I got hit with no fundraising events during COVID for 2 years. I went into arrears over $250,000 in my office in Brooklyn, the best pregnancy center location in the country. I got PPP money of $100,000. I just put down $100,000 towards a 2-year settlement with the building to stay in that pregnancy center location with Planned Parenthood, same building.
God bless them for even being open to that.
Yeah, and so I was able
I mean, you to gave them, I mean, that the crisis of COVID gave them a real good opportunity just to give you the boot.
Well, I managed to save the place, but I got a lot of money to have to raise. So anybody that's listening to this, if you could.
Yeah, we're going to put your link. Give us the website, but I'm definitely going to put the link in the show notes.
EMC Frontline, E for expectant, M for mother, C for care, emcfrontline.org, O-R-G. And this is where you can make a donation. Sign up for a monthly gift. Sign up for $7,000 a month to keep me in the same building seconds away on the elevator with the same elevator with the killers and the victims.
So your rent is $7,000 a month?
Yes, includes that, electric and
that
real
seems
estate.
Like a for that address seems like quite the deal.
Yeah, well, it's a 5-6 room office. It's not huge, but it's adequate for our needs, and we have to spend money, lots of it, on advertising. We have to do pay nurses, and in one case I have a doctor working for us, and I have counselors, bilingual counselors. There's a lot to do.
Now, when I asked you how did the terminal diagnosis, and when I saw you at the March for Life, no, it wasn't the March for Life. It was at the Jackson, not the Dobbs ruling, but the Jackson ruling. When I saw
at the Supreme Court.
At the Supreme Court, I didn't recognize you.
Yeah, I was thin. I lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
I'd gone down to, I mean, I'm 6'1", and I was in my 180s for most of my adult life. And I went down last December to 128 pounds. I had lost my appetite completely, not from COVID, but from the chemo. I couldn't eat. I had no appetite. I had no hunger. Food was disgusting to me. Even a look at a commercial with food advertised. I didn't want to look at food. I couldn't eat. I had to force myself to just get a couple of hundred calories a day.
Yeah, when I saw you, I don't know if you remember this. I was running past you. I was running past you, and you said, Jason. I was like, oh, hi. Like, I just thought you were somebody I met at a pro-life banquet or something.
Yeah, you didn't recognize me.
I didn't. And then somebody said, Chris lost some weight. I said, Chris who? And then I ran back and I tried to play it off. I was like, Chris, sorry, I got swept away. I had to run over there to do an interview, which I did. I had to do a TV interview. I had to do a TV interview, but I did not recognize you. But then when I saw
you. And I had a blocked colon at that time. I was so sick. Randall Terry of Operation Rescue. He drove me. I had driven down and I got a lot of pain on the way down. And I could hardly sleep that night before the going to the Supreme Court. And I said, Randall, I just got to get home. I'm going to faint. I got so much pain. And what I didn't realize, it was my first time that my colon blocked up with my cancer. And so he drove me back in my own car. And my wife met me at Newark Airport and he flew to Memphis from there. And I, where he's from now. And my wife had another car and the two of us, my son drove back the car that she came out in and then she drove my car back home. And I was in the emergency room the next day.
So this was just the day after. So you were in the emergency room the day after I saw you.
Yeah, I was literally at a blocked colon. And I had to have a stent put in to open up my colon. And this happened to me again. When I'm with Randall Terry again, I'm sharing a room with him and his son out at the Napa Institute annual conference in Napa Valley, California. It's a Catholic high-end conference and spiritual experience. Everyone's feasting out there, great food, drink, and my colon blocks up again. And I didn't want to go to a hospital in California. I toughed it out for 3 days. Randall and I drove to the Sacramento airport, for which I had two flights. I was in excruciating pain. And my wife picked me up at the LaGuardia airport and took me right to the emergency room. And I had, had to go through another stent in place. And that's why next week, this can't go on. My colon's blocking my, being blocked by my cancer. Next Thursday, September 22nd, I don't know when this is going to air, but
it's going to air today. It airs today. So we'll pray for you. So
I am having my cancer surgically removed next Thursday, September 22nd, but I still have cancer in my lungs. So I'm going to have radiation treatment. I may live for a couple more years.
Praise God.
But I'm going to fight like heck I'm going to fight for life, for myself, for the sake of so many other lives that I have a unique talent for saving. Trying to be modest about it, but I'm good at saving babies and mothers. And I want to keep doing it.
Well, God, you know what?
Give me extra time.
You have the fortitude. I mean, it's not easy work, and the courage. And when you know that there's over a Madison Square Garden, you can fill Madison Square Garden with folks that have been saved because of the work of your organization. I mean, that really has to get you to push on. But I want to get back to this point. So when I asked you about what your first thought was, but when I said it, I didn't recognize you after the Jackson hearing. When I saw you at this event that I did with at LifeSite News, it was a beautiful event, this gala in Naples, Florida. Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, was the keynote speaker. And you were there. And you looked really good.
Great speech. Yeah, I was
you looked great. You looked great. So you say it's terminal, and the doctor gave you, I guess, 2 years to live. But when I saw you almost last year, I guess not about 8 months, nine months ago.
Chemo had suppressed the growth of the cancer for a year. But then the second stent, and they did a lot of testing, and they realized that this thing is just going to be a permanent problem of growth in the colon. I've got to get the cancer out. And then I have to deal with it spread to other parts of the body. Fortunately, the suppression of by the chemo of the growth, which, lost my hair because of that, it slowed things down, giving me buying more time for me.
Praise God.
So
now,
all of these things, the stents, the surgery, the chemo are all buying me more time. And that's what we do that's what the pro-life movement does. We buy more time. Buy more time for the ultimate decision makers, the moms. We buy them time to think it through, to make the right decision with some input with the ultrasounds, with the offer of help, with the prayer, bringing them back to Jesus, or acquainting them with God's love and mercy. Whatever, we give them time to think it through, because they have to make the decision. The mothers are the most empowered generation. They can make their decision for life or for death. We just have to be there alongside of them, accompanying them in their making of their decision, which they make freely. We never force on mothers the decision. You could say, well, you outlaw abortion, you forced women. Well, in this country, I'm sorry, unless we get a constitutional amendment, it's not likely we're ever going to outlaw abortion nationwide. And, you know, you can try to ban late-term abortions as they're trying to do in Washington this week. It's not going to happen with this Congress, that's for sure. But it's if Republicans take back control, can you ban abortion nationally? I don't think it's constitutional. I mean, others would.
No, that's why that. I've always argued that my end goal, I wrote a 40-year plan. You probably know about this. I wrote a 40-year plan in 1991. I wrote a 40-year plan in 1991. And I put that in 2022, Roe v. Wade would overturn. In 2031, we would have a human life amendment to the Constitution. So the idea that we would even think that we could have a national prohibition of abortion, it, you know, didn't seem to make sense. So the idea is we would need eventually to amend the Constitution.
I believe so.
Because I agree with the Supreme Court that the founding fathers weren't thinking about abortion when they drafted. You know, there wasn't in the founders' realm of thought. So we can't pretend that it was on either side if we are being honest.
Right, being honest.
So, but I want to go back. I promised you only an hour. We're now an hour and 34 minutes in. So I asked you, like, what were your first thoughts? You talked about continuing to fight for life. You talked about your bucket list. When I asked you about how it impacted your spiritual life, you said it's nice to have people pray for you. But what I really want to know is, because, look, of all of us listening, you were given a terminal diagnosis from cancer. But If everyone listening to this podcast around the world, some of us are going to die before you, Chris. We don't know. I might tomorrow. We don't know. My brother just had a stroke. Brian Kemper just had a stroke. So the founder of Rock for Life and Stand True Ministries. So all of us don't know what's waiting for us around the corner. Now you don't know either. There could be a miracle. There could be a cure. But for right now, the doctors, you got a couple years, best case scenario. What I want to know is, how did this change your prayer life for you? Like, how did it, when your quiet times, when you're lying in bed, you're thinking about this, like, maybe I'm not going to be here next summer. Is this my last summer? Is this my last 4th
of July? I'm not dwelling on it. I'm not.
You don't think about it at all?
I'm not afraid of it. I'm trying not to focus on it. I'm not.
Is it you're just so grounded in your faith that you love God? You know, well, he's there, and you trust the sacraments. And
for 40 years, I do daily prayer. I pray the rosary. I do know that my goal in life is to do God's will. That's it.
That's it.
So I don't have to worry, as long as I'm trying to do his will and I'm trying to worship him faithfully, and I'm trying to stay in communion with him and in state of grace, I don't have to worry. This is all a cocktail hour. This entire life on earth is a cocktail hour. To the concept of eternity is something we can't get our minds around. But we are destined to a long, an eternal life. And we want it to be with God. We want it to be as close to him as we can possibly get. And so we have to get ourselves ready. And that means we have to pray a lot. We have to listen to the Holy Spirit a lot. And we have to want to bring others to God as we go and as you get to the point where you think you don't have much time left, you don't have to beat around the bush as much with people. You can tell them, okay, how's your prayer life? How's your walk with Jesus? How's your soul?
You know, I don't think you ever beat around the bush with anyone about anything, though.
Well, I don't want to be a complete pest, but I do want people to get closer to God, and that's how I used to counsel the mothers and not be afraid to bring God into the conversation. And when you're sick, and when you need to amp up the conversation about God with your friends, with your family, and they're not going to criticize you for doing it. So it's a great blessing to share the cross with Jesus. We all have problems. How many of us go the day without without problems?
I told you when I first called you before we got on the air, I said, this has been a rough day with our work in Afghanistan. Yeah. It's really been a rough 48 hours with very little sleep. And
everybody's got something going on.
Everyone's got a battle.
Most Americans, their 401k or IRAs are crashed badly in the last week, or this whole year has been a disaster financially for many, with inflation, gas prices, and stock market crash. So it's, we have our problems, but we must unite those problems to Christ, with Christ on the cross, and realize the redemptive value of offering this suffering, these challenges, these crosses, offering them up with Jesus to the Father. And with the Holy Spirit, we will gain graces. We will be closer to God and understand how he came to save us and how we want to go to heaven with him. If we stay in his good graces, if we accept what comes our way and not get angry at him and realize this is not punishment, this is expiation.
Yeah. What I'm getting is, I think a lot of us, when we get that terminal diagnosis, when the doctor says, hey, the final exam's coming up in a year or two or three, we're going to start cramming for the final. But what I'm hearing you saying is you've been studying for the final your whole life.
Well,
you don't feel any sort of like, I have to get right with God. I have to, you're going along the way you were.
I had my first trial when I was 15 years old with the cancer of the lymph glands, which was terminal. And I had radiation treatment to cure that. And I'm a lifetime.
Say that one more time.
I had cancer. I had a terminal illness when I was 15 years old.
Oh my gosh.
1970. Yeah. And I was skin and bones before, and I was cured. And a mother who was going through a very rough pregnancy offered all her sacrifice of her very difficult pregnancy for me.
Unbelievable.
This I was told by my own mother. And I realized that God had a special, and I remember that was the year that when I was 15, that was the year 1973.
Unbelievable.
It was a little bit later, but I mean, I was in those years. Those were the years where abortion was being legalized. And by the way, I got to know the abortion king. I got to know Dr. Bernard Nathanson. And in my early years of pro-life, I learned to be merciful and forgive.
Did you know him before he was pro-life?
No, I didn't. Okay. No, I knew him after he came over, but I knew of him, and I got to meet him around the time that he introduced the videos, the silent scream that was on VHS tape in those days. And, I became good friends with him, and he actually asked me when he became a Catholic. He wanted to become a Catholic. He asked me if I would be his confirmation sponsor, and I was there for his first communion, his confirmation.
Unbelievable. So were you guys close friends?
We were friends. Yeah, I had events. I was over at his house. We had events. He did fundraising for us. He did some prenatal care for a couple of my kids. He came in and served some of our mothers in our pregnancy center on 23rd Street. Yeah, I saw his breakup of his marriage to his second wife, Adele Nathanson. And then, you know, I saw him marry his next wife when he came into the church, get married again. And I got to know her and I was there in the final days before he died at his home on the Upper West Side. And I brought up the gifts at the St. Patrick's Cathedral at his funeral.
Was he, so I got to was know he him, able
the
to,
abortion for, king.
You know, this is just, I'm just asking, trying to come from a position of empathy. I have a hard time seeing how God could forgive me for my sins or forgiving myself.
Yeah.
Did Dr. Nathanson, was he able to feel that he was forgiven, and did he ever forgive himself?
No, he struggled. He struggled mightily with guilt. He had a lot of guilt.
Tell folks who he is. Like how he was. You called him the abortion king. He performed, what, 50,000 abortions?
Well, he said he oversaw 75,000.
Wow.
And, you know, many of those he performed himself, but he had a lot of abortionists working for him. And CRASH, the Center for Reproductive and Sexual Health, was the name of his place in Manhattan.
Okay.
And he became a great pro-lifer.
Yeah, real hero.
He was wonderful. If you can get his books, and they're very expensive on eBay, his old out-of-print books, the abortion papers in Aborting America are floating around back, old out-of-print copies.
And this is a guy who went from being the belle of the ball of polite society, of the beautiful people.
Yeah.
Endless awards, endless dinner parties, endless accolades. And he traded that in at the time to join a fringe movement of Catholics and fundamentalist Christians.
But he really did break through with the production of The Silent Scream and then later The Eclipse of Reason, these two seminal videos that were very important to the movement.
I mean, I would say he's one of the most beautiful souls. When you think of what it was like, and you know because you were there, to come out as a pro-lifer in the 80s, it was now, sure, we're going to be attacked from one side, but we have a pretty big team, right? We're the majority of America. We have our own media outlets. We have our own networks. We have our own community. You know, even though we're maybe censored on Twitter, we have Getter. We have, for everyone that says they hate you, I've got five people that tell me how awesome I am. But what Dr. Nathanson was trading in was all of the advantages of being a part of polite society in exchange for getting to be a part of, and I'm sure as a secular Jewish guy, having to trade in all of his friends for, you know, Catholics walking around with Our Lady of Guadalupe statues and fundamentalist Christians, it had to be a bit jarring and uncomfortable. And so but when he saw that baby flinch and fight for his life when he performed an abortion with an ultrasound for the first time, he had the courage of not hiding from the truth that he saw in that ultrasound. And that makes him, to me, just one of the most tremendous and beautiful human beings that really ever walked the planet. And you, and I feel the same way about you, and you were his friend. You said that this world is a cocktail party. You've been around the interesting folks, right? So you got kicked out of the advertising world. But you knew Cardinal O'Connor, I have to imagine.
I knew Cardinal O'Connor. I met Mother Teresa, John Paul II, three times. I was a good friend of Father Benedict Groeschel of the Franciscan Friars of Renewal. I was a good friend of Father Richard John Newhouse.
What
a
guy.
I had
privilege. Can you tell us about Father Newhouse? I mean, he started as a left-wing Lutheran minister as well.
Yeah, he was a Vietnam War activist and very big civil rights leader, and he was a Lutheran minister, and I became friends with him when he was a Lutheran minister, and introduced him to some Catholic conference contacts, but he had many on his own. He was very ecumenical. He founded this interfaith magazine called First Things. He was the editor of that. at an organization. He used to speak a lot, and he gave me his speech money. He gave me over $100,000 worth of donations over the years.
Unbelievable.
To do my work. And Father Benedict, the same. So we got to know some of the greats who were based in New York. Not Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II, but I got to meet them a few times, get Mother Teresa to pray for my work. I met her in the Bronx, South Bronx. And, you know, been privileged to meet a lot of the greats.
Did you get to know Cardinal
Paul Marx? I got to know him too.
I worked for him. Now, did you get to know Cardinal Avery Dulles?
No, I didn't.
Now, Fulton Sheen passed away. You were still fairly young, and he was probably more or less retired.
I think that was 79.
So did you ever?
I did see him in lying in state at St. Patrick's Cathedral. I think that was the first time I saw him in his casket, but I had watched some of his shows. I probably watched a lot more of them since he died, as most of us have in this generation.
Yeah. So that's it's.
We hope he gets canonized.
Yeah, I pray so. I mean, he is responsible for my wife's conversion. I gave her Peter Kraft's The Journey on our first date and Fulton Sheen's Peace of Soul on our second date. And after she read Peace of Soul, I wasn't Catholic yet myself, but I had my Magnificat and I would go to Mass by myself.
Sure.
And I would just read along. And after she read Peace of Soul, she asked if she could go to Mass with me. So the two of us, neither of us Catholic, would go to daily Mass and sit there and read the Magnificat.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and you got to meet my whole family when we shot Divided Hearts of America in your neighborhood, and we were in New York City.
You were visiting in your wife's old neighborhood of Yonkers, right?
Yeah, so what I did, and I'm by God's grace, so a year before COVID, we were shooting Divided Hearts of America. And it was going to be about a month of shooting in New York City and in Washington, D.C. So for the producers and for some of the production staff and myself and my family, I rented a house in Bronxville, walking distance to my father-in-law's house. And he was 87 at the time. You guys probably worked together. He was a big editor. And he did movie trailers and he did commercials in New York City. But so by God's grace, you know, while I was shooting this movie, my wife and kids were hanging out with Grandpa, Gung Gung, and he died of remdesivir, killed him in a rehab facility after battling back COVID. We made the mistake of we could have sent him home or sent him to what was considered the best rehab facility in New York City. And I said, you know, for your father, only the best. And we sent him to the best rehab facility, and we found out that decision probably led to his death. Because what they gave him, remdesivir, they call it run death is near. I just call it run death is near. My doctor friend told me they call it run death is near. That took his life. But you came over to the house while we were shooting and got to meet my whole family. So that was wonderful.
Yeah, really.
Blessed
with a beautiful family.
What's that, Chris?
So thank you for you're blessed with a beautiful family.
Well, you know, I find that when you stand with the vulnerable, everything beautiful comes, and you have experienced that with your whole life. You got booted from the ad agency, Ad World, but here you were saving babies, filling Madison Square Garden. You probably in New York City every day stroll past somebody who, your work led to their mother choosing life. And that has to be absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, who knows?
Probably. It has to. Just no way. There's just no way that doesn't happen. And then you've made the most wonderful friends like Bernard Nathanson and Father Newhouse. I mean, what a privilege, you know, to know these folks. And
Father Frank Pavone.
Father Frank
Pavone.
He and
I go way back. I go back with him to the days before he was with Priests for Life.
Yeah, no, it's that's what's great about the pro-life movement is now become so big that we don't all know each other. But I remember a time where I kind of felt like I knew everybody in the pro-life, every pro-life leader I knew. Yeah. And now the movement is so wild, so big, diverse. And what's not, you probably know this, the radical left has found the pro-life cause again. And I would say some of our best activists are coming from the left, like this group POW with Teresa Bukovniak and her friends.
Sure.
And they are leftists, hardcore. And they, you are someone, what's interesting, I don't know if you know this, but you are someone they greatly look up to and admire.
Oh, that's kind
and
of it.
And it's it's because you do the work that they love. Like, they love doing rescues, and they are not playing games. Teresa Bukovniak tweeted, abortion kills a child, act like you know it. And then it was like hashtag.
That's similar to what Randall Terry said in the old days.
Yeah, well, she's greatly been greatly influenced, and these leftist groups have been greatly influenced.
Randall Terry said in the mid-'80s, if you believe abortion is murder, act like it's murder.
Yeah, no, and we're seeing this from groups on the left. So, Chris, I just want to thank you for your work, and I'm praying for a miracle.
Thank you.
From God or from science, from our medical professionals or from our Lord. But I do know that that you will continue to exemplify courage and fortitude in serving women and their preborn children. And for me, it's been a blessing to be your friend. So I'm so glad you called
me. Thank you, my friend.
And demanded, you know, $50,000 in movie tickets. And I look forward to seeing you again. I'm going to put your website. Give us your website one more time. I'm going to ask everyone, please donate.
Yeah.
And the link, if you don't catch it, is going to be in the show notes.
Yes. EMCfrontline.org.
There you have it.
If you're inclined to come to New York and work with us, go to pro-life interns, no hyphen, ProLifeInterns.com.
ProLifeInterns.com. That is a great website. That is a great place for people to go. I'm about to sell some pillows and some newspapers. I know you have Mike Lindell's products in your house, right?
Yes, I do. I sleep on a My Pillow.
And you love it?
Yes.
Did you use the code Jones when you bought it?
No, I didn't.
you paid full price?
No, I didn't. I never do.
Whose code did you use? Or did Mike give it to you for free?
No, I got it at a discount place.
Oh, all right. All right, my brother. All right, God bless you.
Take care. God bless.
All right, that was the legend, Chris Slattery. If all of us could live our life the way Chris Slattery did, the way the impact that he has had in New York City, I hope you go into the show notes, make a donation to Chris. His organization is being inundated as people are now going to, you know, abortion tourism is in effect in the Big Apple, which has earned its name. It's quite sorrowful, but I'm grateful that I hope and I pray that so many of these young women that are going to the Big Apple for abortions bump into Chris Slattery and his organization and choose life. This episode has been brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project. As I said to Chris earlier, and I mentioned in the interview, it has been a rough day. You know, the work we do at the Vulnerable People Project, and if you go to our website, thegreatcampaign.org, you can see the work that we're doing. The massive amounts of food that we're delivering across Afghanistan, the Christians and other minorities that we are evacuating and bringing to safety, the SIVs, those Afghans who fought alongside our men and women in uniform against the worst terrorists in the world, we're continuing to rescue and serve them until we can rescue them. It is not easy work. It is sometimes a bit overwhelming, and you never want to express it because you feel kind of silly. As overwhelming as our work is, our Afghan partners who work with us are under immense they're under immense stress. They're facing incredible, unimaginable risk, and the people that we're serving are facing imminent death. But for those of us at the Vulnerable People Project working here in the United States, it obviously can be overwhelming. But to stand with the vulnerable is to be overwhelmed. That's to serve those who are drowning is to risk drowning yourself. If you want to stand with the most vulnerable people in the world when they're facing their greatest challenges, from advocating for the child and the womb in the United States to fighting for the Uyghur and Chinese-occupied East Turkestan, or to literally rescuing from the jaws of death Christians, other Afghan minorities, and those SIVs, those Afghans who fought shoulder to shoulder with us longer than any ally, wartime ally in the history of the United States. Those Afghans that were abandoned by Biden fought shoulder to shoulder with Americans for a longer period of time than any of our allies in the history of our republic. So if you want to stand with the truly vulnerable, where it's dangerous and there's cost, go to thegreatcampaign.org, become a monthly donor, and you will be truly advocating for the most vulnerable people in the world during the most challenging times. This episode is also being brought to you, of course, by MyPillow.com. Now, you thought I was over the top. You thought I was over the top when I said you should get the robe and the slippers so when the FBI pulls you out of your bed, you are looking great for your neighbors. You're inspiring jealousy as you are being shoved into the back of a federal police car or paddy wagon or what so it be. You want to look good. You want to be comfortable. And you thought I was kidding. Well, Mike Lindell today was served, I believe, at a fast food restaurant, had his cell phone taken from the FBI. If only Mike had on slippers, he could have showed him and said, use the code Jones. He wouldn't have used my code. But you can use my code. So go to MyPillow.com. Today, if you have never gone, I'm going to say this in the front show too. If you've never bought a MyPillow, you need to buy it today simply to stand in solidarity with Mike Lindell, who is being harassed for being our friend, who is being harassed because of his commitment to election integrity. So go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and get that pillow, to tell these corrupt, decaying, decrepit FBI, whatever, I just got my MyPillow thanks to you. I bought the pillow because you took Mike Lindell's cell phone. I bought the mattress topper because you took Mike Lindell's. I got the Giza Dream Sheets because you took Mike Lindell's cell phone. All right, go to MyPillow.com. And to be free, you have to be informed. And we're used to it. It's like we live in a communist country. I have friends who are raised in communist countries. Like, yeah, we read the paper just to read the lies, to laugh. That is what the mainstream media is. It is actually, we read it for the humor. We read Babylon Bee, a satire site, for the news. We read the normal newspaper for a chuckle to see, oh, this is how they're trying to gaslight me today. But to be free, you have to be informed, and there is no better place to go than Epoch Times. So go to iReadEpoch.com, use the code Jones, and you, for $1 for the first month, $77 for the rest of the year, you can get a subscription to the most important newspaper in the world today, Epoch Times. All right? Until next time, this is Jason Jones with Chris Slattery on The Jason Jones Show.
This has been The Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.